This is WXOJ 103.3 FM Valley Free Radio.
You will not be able to stay home, brother.
It's the Bread and Roses Show. We're here every Friday, 4 to 5 p.m. on Valley Free Radio, streaming at valleyfreeradio.org. And in the background, in the foreground, is Gil Scott Heron.
The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial.
And on the Bread and Roses show, we talk about a range of issues related to creating a fair economy and social justice. And today we have some high voltage here in the studio. There are three younger men who are all organizers, active organizers. And we also have a camera person here. So while Gil Scott Heron said the revolution will not be televised, it may be YouTube, right? I mean, that's the question for us here today, is can we use the vehicles of social networking as one resource to build solidarity, to communicate among people? And even though Gil Scott Heron couldn't foresee that there was this possibility that perhaps there could be decentralized media, independent media, like we're right here on Low Power FM as part of a larger movement for indie media in this country. So what we're going to do today is these folks have gathered here. It's great to have you in the studio to talk about initially the fee hikes that the trustees are considering and I guess have approved, or I'm not sure. I know the two of you were out at the meeting last week, the trustee meeting. Or Ben, you were at the meeting last week, Wednesday, mm-hmm. I guess, in Boston,
mm-hmm.
and to talk about the fee hike, and then the larger issue of the neoliberal, the austerity assault that's going on public education and on public resources, on working people, on the working class, and how to resist, and particularly the organizing efforts that you're involved with, we'll be talking about. So that's the show today here on Bread and Roses. I'm Joel Sachs. We have in the studio here with us Joe Merkin. Joe, welcome.
Hello, thank you.
Good to see you here.
Happy to be here.
Ben Taylor, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome. And Patrick Burke.
Hey.
And as far as I know, Patrick is an organizer with... Tell us what you're organizing, Patrick.
I work with Jobs with Justice in Western Mass as the Student Labor Action Project organizer. I'm also a board member of the Public Higher Education Network of Massachusetts.
And Ben, you're organizing?
I'm an organizer with the Public Higher Education Network of Massachusetts, and I work with the International Socialist Organization.
And Joseph?
Oh, I'm pretty unaffiliated. I'm just a UMass alum for the purposes of this conversation.
You have been involved. You were a phenomenal organizer. You weren't you organizing statewide? Efforts to
at UMass I was involved with the student government and we did some attempt at statewide organizing against fee increases and corporatization of the university mm-hmm. since graduating was involved with the Justice for Jason campaign and mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. other than that, you know, just kind of try to stay abreast of the issues, have conversations with folks like yourselves who are still involved with groups and know what's going on.
Daniel, how is the shot? Is the shot
good?
Okay? Okay,
yep.
All right.
Cool.
So let's start out by just telling us a little bit about what happened, what the issue is around fee hikes.
So I can give a little bit of the backstory on that. So the fee hikes meeting was held at UMass Boston June 8th, last Wednesday. And basically... what they were aiming to do was address a structural deficit that the university system was facing of $54.5 million. And what they were aiming to do was cover half of that deficit with a 7.5% fee hike, which is something on the order of $800 per student, and covering the other half of that by slashing close to 400 jobs across the university system. So they ended up approving the fee hike. This is the second time in 2 years that they've done a fee hike, and it's part of a long-term trend of shifting the cost for running this public institution from the state onto the shoulders of students.
When you say it's a follow-up, now I understand that the federal stimulus monies postponed for a period of time the fee increase. What happened with that? Was there some kind of kick-up? And what happened?
So I can explain that a little bit. So you know, as everyone you know probably recalls, you know we've been through a pretty a wild ride with the economy the last couple of years since the bottom dropped out of the housing market. The big stimulus bill that was pushed for by Obama and the Democrats back in 2008-2009, which ran essentially through last year. Yeah. Was a big chunk of that was directed towards states to help them fill in holes in their budgets. So what we saw with the University of Massachusetts system specifically, starting either last year or the year before, the state actually cut a giant hole out of their funding for public higher education, and then used federal stimulus dollars to backfill that so that it was at level funding. Knowing full well, of course, that these federal dollars were one-time dollars. The problem, of course, is the narrative that we've been hearing from both from the trustees at the Board of Trustees meeting, and that's been repeated widely from the Boston Globe to the Daily Hampshire Gazette to the Republican, the Springfield Republican. They've been stating it as if the reason why this university system is facing a deficit is because those federal dollars disappeared, as if you know, the state hadn't slashed a big hole. Mm. So I think that there's a bit of a misdirection that we've been seeing. And really, the big culprit here is that the state has once again slashed funding for public higher education.
So what impact does that have, Ben, the research you've done, in terms of the ability of a range of people to go to school, particularly working class, lower income students? What has your research, what you've found, university, and then if any of that evidence also carry your research in terms of even access to community colleges, some of the reading I've done indicates that it's ever harder for lower income students even to go to community college for a range of reasons. So whatever information you can provide, both in terms of higher ed on the university level, but also state and community colleges.
So I can give just a kind of a brief overview. One of the most interesting things that I found was that I looked at minimum wage in the state of Massachusetts from 1977 up until today, you know, adjusting for inflation, and I found that it was essentially level all the way across. That a student job, you know, working 10 hours a week, 50 weeks out of the year. And then I looked at tuition and fees to attend UMass Amherst specifically, and what I found. Kind of just roughed up a little chart. What I found was that the flat line, that's a minimum wage. The other line that you see there is tuition and fees. And so back in 1977, it was possible working 10 hours a week at minimum wage, you know, 50 weeks out of the year, to pay your way through UMass Amherst, graduating not only with no debt, but with enough extra money to pay for things like, you know, textbooks or food. what we saw, though, was by about 1983, 1984, through, you know, cutting and funding for public higher education, that the cost to attend the university was now about level with what a student job would bring in. By about 95, 96, we saw a precipitous decline in state funding, leading to, you know, massive increase. And that's essentially continued unabated to the present day. Now, if a student wanted to work their way through through the University of Massachusetts and graduate with no debt, they would need to work close to 60 hours a week at minimum wage, which is, of course, impossible. not to mention, you know, if you were just looking to get that much employment altogether in this economy, it would be hard to find. But then you add on to that going to school full time, and it's just not a task that any student could do. So the result, of course, has been that the average student is now graduating from the university system with over $24,000 in debt. And that's a number that grows year by year. And, of course, student debt is the hardest form of debt to get rid of. You can't get rid of it through bankruptcy. students, you know, you see constant cases, anecdotal cases. And Stephanie Kraft wrote a really good article back in October called Killer Loans, which really laid out that, this was in the Valley Advocate, which really laid out that not only do students graduate, you know, with tens of thousands of dollars in debt, but that these debts actually grow larger over the years, that a number of people find themselves with their student debt actually doubling, you know, within a decade or two of leaving school. And so it really is a modern day indentured servitude. It's a crisis.
Did you come across numbers in terms of what the median income of students? Your chart is very important. I started in the Valley. I actually started at Hampshire in '76 and took classes at UMass in the econ department. The whole feeling of UMass was very different at that time. And I don't know and haven't done the research, but I think I'm sure that the median income of students from then to now. Mm-hmm. Is dramatically different. And I don't know if you've come across any numbers of what the median income is of students, but I mean, we know that the strategy of the university, as it's building more housing, is to bring in more out-of-state students who are going to pay more money, and the more it generates more revenue, the more they bring in these students, the less access, obviously, Massachusetts residents will have.
Absolutely.
And those on the lower end will be cut out. Did you come across any information like that?
I don't have any of that information specifically on hand, but it's definitely something that you know, it's a changing character we've been seeing across the system. It's one of the, you know, perverse incentives that we've seen that's actually now been ratified for the entire, you know, public higher education system, is that now, you know, all of the 29 campuses across the state are able to retain out-of-state tuition on campus. What that does, of course, is it gives a new perverse incentive for those campuses to, you know, recruit, you know, as much as they can out-of-state students to come to their campuses, once again undermining the in-state working class character of what should be a public institution.
And just what we're seeing as Phenom reminds us that for the first time last year, I think it was, students' families were putting in more money to the budget than the state was. So this idea, is it actually really a public institution anymore? When students, when families, when the public is paying more, right, than the state is actually, how do you consider it to be really a public university anymore when there's less and less subsidy from the state for education?
That's a good question.
I mean, the scale is tipped now, and that's happening across the country. It's not just here in Massachusetts.
Massachusetts has been leading the way on this on this front of privatizing public higher education, but I don't think the other states are too far behind now. We just saw that big crisis out in California just a couple of years ago, where you know, they had like a massive like 30% fee hike, you know, at the same time that they were slashing, you know, state funding. So people, you know, students were doing what we're doing here in Massachusetts, which is every year we're paying more money for less of an education as our faculty gets laid off, as you know, teaching assistants get squeezed more and more, and classrooms get overflowed with students looking for an education.
And then there's the kind of end goal, or the question of what do you get for all of this, when we see that the unemployment rate among college age youth is about 22%, and a recent New York Times study that took Bureau of Labor Statistics over the last year found that 22% unemployment, 22% of the jobs that college-age adults were getting, graduates, did not require a college degree. So 55% of the jobs that you're getting require a college degree, and and the average, the median wage was $27,000, which is hardly enough. If you've gone into debt to pay rent, right, to pay whatever other credit card debt you may have, and university debt. So why do the college education in the first place? I mean, that's a question that at least gets raised in the whole kit and caboodle of it. And as radicals, as people who are questioning the dominant political economy, at least I think all of us in this room share that that kind of question. Mm-hmm. There's a larger radical question here of, like, what do we really want our society to look like? I mean, maybe on mm-hmm. some level, truly radical level, mm-hmm. we need to think in a much larger way mm-hmm. about the paradigm, about mm-hmm. the dominant paradigm, and how we create a fair economy. Mm-hmm. And that's a larger discussion perhaps we can get to. But, I mean, there are all these issues there that are raised because it's a parchment promise that is not fulfilled.
Absolutely.
You know, I feel I teach as a lecturer, a part-time lecturer in the Department of Communication, and one of the images that comes to me is of all these faculty and graduate students who are, you know, kind of beating the drum, the piper, leading the lemmings to the cliff. Mm-hmm. We sell this bill of goods, mm-hmm. and everybody's got the horse blinders on, like this is going to mean anything, mm-hmm. when in fact, we're all complicit. I mean, all the faculty are complete. I mean, one thing I have to say about Phenomen, it's a question we have here is, okay, we get this 7.5% fee hike. Have mm-hmm. they approved it? Is it formally approved?
It's been formally yeah. approved, yeah.
So it's an estimated $800. Mm-hmm. That'll be the hit. Mm-hmm. Now, what has Phenom said? What have the faculty mm-hmm. who, in some ways, are looking to cover their booty mm-hmm. right here, mm-hmm. has anything... I looked on the Phenom website. I didn't see any mention of it. Mm-hmm. What's their position?
I mean, we definitely did get some supporters from the different faculty unions at the UMass Boston, you know, Board of Trustees meeting, and some people did actually speak you know, officially at that meeting, you know, they made a pretty clear case that that what the Board of Trustees was doing was, you know, acting as a rubber stamp body, you know, enabling the state to continue the process of, you know, cutting funding, shifting the cost onto students. You know, one of the points that was shocking for me that one of the faculty speakers raised was that on the topic of, you know, working class and, you know, actual accessibility, that I believe over the last decade at UMass Boston alone, students of color have declined by 25%, you know, which is a pretty shocking statistic. The big issue, of course, is that the state is cutting everywhere. You know, it always cuts public higher education because it's easy to do it. You know, you can just say, well, we'll shift the cost onto students. That's not something that's as easy to do in a lot of other parts of the public sector. But of course, this year we're seeing broad cuts, you know, about $1.2 billion in cuts across the whole public sector. It's at a time when the state has other options for revenue. There's a bill that's being talked about, and it was raised by one of the faculty members at the UMass Boston Board of Trustees meeting. It's called an Act to Invest in Our Communities. What it would do is effectively it's a targeted tax. It kind of works around the ban in the Constitution of Massachusetts against a graduated income tax by raising the income tax up to 5.95%, up from 5.3%, while doubling the exemption. The effect is that it actually targets the top 1% almost exclusively of income earners in the state, raising about $1.2 billion in revenue. And really, it's the question, you know, who should be paying for the crisis that the state is facing? Should it be the people who are already struggling, who are already facing, you know, massive debt to go to public higher education, who are already, you know, in other ways, immiserated by this economy? Or should we be asking the people who are earning, you know, 6-7 figures a year to pay a little bit more?
Well, that's the question. And I mean, I think that's where, on some level, we all have to go. I think one of the challenges here is informing, giving the public really good information about what we want. I today's papers, the Springfield Republican, local news, reports, as you say, the cuts are coming across the board. It's not mm-hmm. just higher education. Mm-hmm. In East Hampton, at a standing room only school committee meeting on Tuesday, more than 75 people showed up, and about 20 voiced strong opposition to a move they said would deprive students of important career skills. And essentially what they're doing is they're cutting the number of shop classes in half. Mm-hmm. Today mm-hmm. also in the Gazette, there's a story about the city council, the Northampton City Council, approving the budget, but that there were a group of parents who aired concerns about looming staff cuts at R.K. Finn Ryan Road School, one of the elementary schools, and specifically several parents of incoming first grade school children at the Ryan Road School said they are deeply troubled that a single teacher with no aides will be overseeing two first grade classes that are projected to have 22 or 23 students. This is the quote from a parent. Quote, tonight, 46 students are counting on us to fight for a fair and equal education for them, said Constance M. Janik, parent of a kindergartner at the school. Quote, tonight, 46 children need you to think about them. I mean, that's outrageous. So the question becomes, and then we know I have here a call from the Jobs with Justice work site for people to turn out to support the Northampton school workers, school employees, who the Northampton school committee voted to basically zero or level fund and ignore the salary increases that are built into the contract. So a kind of Wisconsin-like action, union busting, and just abrogating the idea of bargaining in good contract. They're having a rally to defend school workers Thursday, June 23rd at 6:30 p.m. at the JFK Middle School here in Northampton, 100 Bridge Road, Florence. And the issue here is that it's kind of between a rock and a hard place. We're demanding more of these. In these instances, there's not a whole lot there, right? So in terms of generating a grassroots uprising, right? We just saw in Italy, Berlusconi lost several regional elections for the first time. And he lost a major referendum that cuts into his power. And the reading I've done about it, this was just this last week, was that it was largely young people who were mobilized that, that made the difference in that election. And then we see, you know, we see in Spain the same kind of thing we saw in Germany, the uprising of people, the massive hundreds of thousands of people turning out in different parts of Germany for the Greens against different kinds of development, nuclear energy, forced Angela Merkel to announce that nuclear energy would be phased out in 2022. Was this groundswell of people who were empowered with the knowledge of what they wanted in terms of equity, a fair economy. We're not there. At least we're not there yet, right? So the I mean, one of the questions is we need to have a sense of what do we want, and you're putting forward that. I read Jobs with Justice is putting forward the call for people to attend this Wall Street protest called by the National Nurses Union, Wall Street, June 22nd, and one of the things they're asking, and it's an international day of protest. Called by European unions, part of a worldwide campaign to make the corporate finance thieves pay to rebuild the global economy. In the U.S., and I'm reading from their website here, this is the website of the National Nurses United, and it's the National Nurses Union, is that what it's called?
Yes,
National?
Yes, yeah.
National, I forget the name of it exactly.
Yeah. Massachusetts Nurses Association are also a member.
Their affiliate.
Yep.
But what they're suggesting would be the way we could raise this and deal with the deficit, cover the deficit, is a sales tax on the buying and selling of stocks, bonds, derivative, credit default swaps, and other financial machinations that are not untaxed and have put so many families in peril. So there's a specific proposal that apparently is being called on in France and Brazil, all over the European Union. People will be demonstrating for this next. Is the 22nd Tuesday?
22nd is a Wednesday.
Next Wednesday. Yep. So there's a specific demand, but how do we get that word out there? I mean, and this gets to the issue of organizing. If people don't have a sense of what they want, how are we? What's the organizing? What are the strategies that people are using right now to mobilize young people and communities around these issues? And Patrick, you're if you want to say something about the organizing you're doing.
Yeah. We just talked about a heck of a lot of stuff right there. I think, you know, it's really a multifaceted, you know, issue, because you are dealing with
you know, the specific issues that are being dealt with by youth in Europe and youth in the Middle East are really not that much different than what we have here. High unemployment, debt, lacking a political voice, you know, even political repression in some aspects. If you look at what's going on in parts of this country, you know, it's the high costs for, you know, common goods. You know, those pressing, very pocketbook issues are affecting youth in the United States, just like they're affecting youth across the world. But we're not seeing the same kinds of eruptions, you know, at least sustained and, you know, as massive. But we are seeing them, you know, and I think it, you know, it's really a question of good organizing, of really trying to tap into what makes sense to people on the ground level. You know, in California, they have done a lot of great stuff. Their statewide student association, groups like USAS, SLAP, you know, socialist groups, you know, a lot of different, you know, radical student groups have been able to, you know, organize in California, you know, doing the sit-ins and large rallies and really making a point. It was I saw recently that the governor of California vetoed the budget that had been passed by Democrats, probably for the wrong reasons, probably for more cuts. But what was interesting, though, was at least there the head of the University of California system said, you cannot cut public higher education anymore. This is it, you know, and they made a very strong stance about that. We haven't seen that in Massachusetts. We don't see the leadership of our colleges and universities in the public sector saying, you know, you cannot cut us anymore. You know, we cannot, you know, take it. This is an attack on our students. Now, of course, in California, it came with a lot of tumultuous action, a lot of organizing, and of course, you know, their position, it's still not satisfactory for students or faculty or staff in the California system. You know, they're still looking at, you know, privatization, even if some of those cuts are restored. But you know, I think, you know, it is an interesting thing, and I'd be curious to hear a bit more from you, Joe, because I know you were involved a bit when there was a big strike at UMass.
Yeah, that was going back a few years now. And yeah, to be honest, I don't know if Phenom was really even around when that strike took place. It may have been around that period, but certainly a lot of the organizing for the strike at UMass was primarily graduate students and undergraduate students. Four demands. One was to roll back fees. One was get the police out of the dorms who were doing, some would say, illegal undercover busts of people for relatively minor stuff. Another of the demands was to provide more diversity in where the graduate fellowships were being awarded, so that it didn't continue to reinforce systemic dynamics of oppression in the university. And I don't... Yeah, I mean, I really don't remember a whole lot about...
When was this, Joe?
This was in 2007, I believe. There was a hell of a lot of student support. There were like 1,500, maybe more students that came out in March. It was snowing that day. It was a two-day-long strike. There were teach-ins. You know, students opted to not attend their normal class in order to go to workshops, some led by other students, some led by graduate students, some led by community activists and other folks from the area, and some just, you know, also led by professors, but they were alternate to the courses they would have been teaching. Unfortunately, I think a lot of the organization that came together for that action, you know, just being the nature of student organizing, I think people graduate, people kind of leave the area, people disappear from the campus, people get put into different situations where they're not so much focused on organizing at UMass anymore. And I can personally say that, you know, I was involved a lot as a student, and I thought that even when I graduated, I'd be able to maintain a level of involvement and stay up on the issues, be on campus regularly, attend meetings, attend events, attend protests. But it gets hard once you've left the campus, and I'm not even that far away. I just moved to Northampton, you know, let alone the folks I know who left UMass, graduated, and have moved all over the country. It's, you know, it's your job starts to take over, and student organizing has to rely on a brand new generation of students.
Let me just say, this is WXOJ 103.3 FM Valley Free Radio. It's the Bread and Roses show, and we're here talking about the fee hikes that the UMass trustees voted on last Wednesday, 7.5% fee hike coming on earlier fee hikes, and just general escalating cost of higher ed, and the larger neoliberal austerity cuts that are coming because of the tremendous greed of Wall Street financiers, the FIRE, finance, insurance, real estate, oligopoly, plutocracy that is now running our economy, that are basically a bunch of people who are doing nothing but a lot of shell game. I mean, that's also like part of this whole picture is we have these people who are running the economy who are doing nothing except sitting there and flipping papers and playing this casino capitalism with our lives. And it's just amazing to me, the lack of resistance. Oh, I mean, we have Wisconsin, you know, there are these isolated issues, but they're all on this, on the fighting their stopgap measures, right? I mean, we have very little forward action. One of the things that is, I know, different, the UC system compared to our system, is that, first of all, it has a much larger number of first generation young people who are the first generation of families who are going to school, Asian students, Latino students, Chicano students. There's a much larger working class population at these schools. In the Bay Area, you have the collective memory of resistance from the Black Panthers. There are still very, very active, vital, radical organizations where that memory has lived in the Oakland Bay Area, is still active. And in Southern California, you also have organizations that are there from the 60s, the 70s. There's a collective memory. I mean, as a lecturer, I'm teaching in the communications department, and I'm teaching on issues of youth in the entertainment industries. And one of the things that concerns me greatly is that the 20-something generation, as some people have dubbed them the millennials, there is a kind of pipeline, a corporate pipeline in and out, where when you think back on it, the food that people eat, the songs they hear, the stories that they've been weaned on, the clothes they wear, the games they play, the cars they drive. The whole scene is a corporate scene. People, that's the reality that people have been raised on. I have a tape here. Maybe we should play it. I spent a number of years doing oral histories of old Jewish radicals, the old Jewish communist movement. I grew up in Miami, and there was a whole subculture of Jewish radicals who were there, and I spent about a decade with them in their last days. And also as they existed in New York, which was really their center when they came from pre-revolutionary Russia. So these are people who were outsiders in Eastern Europe, truly outsiders. I mean, they were a demonized people. And they also had a very strong autonomous culture out of Judaism, of that went way back in terms of Kultur, a culture that bound them together. Certain rituals, a language, it's a multilingual, both Hebrew and Yiddish, and then the language. And there were this fabric of outsiderness and also cultural solidarity that bound them together. They brought that from Russia to the Lower East Side. Let me play this just to hear kind of a slice of this is in the teens in New York. Joe, is there a... actually, I'll be able. We can all listen to it together. I'll turn on the mics here. But just to preface, this is on the Lower East Side. This is Willie Soranko, who was a lifelong communist in the CP, Communist Party, joined around this period in the late 20s, and up till the last days of his life, he was still in the party. And you know, he was a Stalinist. I mean, he became a Stalinist and had that hard line. What I recognize and appreciate about the CP, as much as it was diluted and followed this distorted line that ultimately, I think, well, I'm not going to say they ruined themselves, although I think they tremendously undermined the line, the dogmatism of the CP, what it did to it. But I think ultimately their destruction was a product of the tremendous repression, the blacklisting in this country, the Cold War, that still resonates in the anti-communism that makes it impossible for us to talk about any alternatives to capitalism. So the effect of the blacklisting, the Cold War, the attack on communism, the anti-communism, is still a prejudice. But anyway, what you'll hear here is him talking about the Lower East Side working class Jewish Yiddish culture. He refers to Shalom Aleichem, who was one of the leading Yiddish writers of the time. Shalom Aleichem, peace be with you. It's like An Salam Aleichem. So these writers took these names. And he wrote Fiddler on the Roof, which is his most well-known, that was adapted into a movie and a Broadway show. But let me play this piece here.
It's made you, what was it in your childhood, your young...
You're talking about 1920?
You're going to... Yeah.
There was a Schnorrer organization. They called themselves Beggars.
Right.
On Second Avenue. And they used to... around 11th Street, Second Avenue, where the Schwartz Theater, Second Avenue and 11th Street. And they used to come in young writers, Jewish writers, used to come in Shalom Aleichem. You heard of Shalom
Aleichem? Yeah, yeah.
He used to come in himself because they read his work. Somebody that was there, Harris, was such a good reader of his work. And I was active in that literary club. Shalom Aleichem invited me with another couple of friends to come to the Bronx to cup of tea. Twice we were in his house. Wonderful individual. There was a fellow, a writer, Avraham Raisin. He used to sit in the Royal Restaurant, Second Avenue, with the actors, the writers, the musicians, composers. And he liked me and I liked him. I was a very vigorous writer. And I used to recite his poem. The poem is made music, but I don't care for the music because Second Avenue, a musician wrote the music. I didn't care.
What was the poem?
And the chorus used to sing it, but I'm reciting it. You heard it?
What poem?
I'll tell you. This is called The New Time, The Nahe Zeit. The poem, The New Time. You understand a little Jewish?
Yeah, say it in Jewish.
I can translate to English if you want.
No, no, do it in Jewish and then translate.
Und so wie weit, die neue Zeit. Und so wie weit, die neue Zeit, Novent und all weit, kommen wird.
Okay, I'm going to fade this out here. So it's a moment. I mean, the kinds of things he talks about of just space, that these people are all concentrated together. You know, he remembers Second Avenue and 11th Street, you know, and the musicians, the writers, the composers, and this anthem, this poem, The new time, the night side, and if you translate it, it's a visioning kind of document of what a better society would look like. That was part of the fabric that was written by Avraham Raisin, a workers' writer, as he called them. So there was this way in which the swirl of everyday life was mixed. Mm-hmm. It was thoroughly intertwined with a culture of resistance and solidarity. There was there were historical conditions there. These were working people. He was working in a textile factory, a sweatshop on the Lower East Side. And it was down the street. The cafeterias were there, the coffee shops were there. They were all together. And there was a rhythm of time and space and culture, that they owned, that they created. It was theirs. And you saw that taken into the 1930s in the development of the trade union and the militancy of that. And then in the 1960s, the civil rights into the Black Power movement, there was also that outsiderness, right? Tremendous persecution, the bigotry, mm-hmm. and a intact community, of which the church was a primary force, mm-hmm. the Black church, and keeping people together, mm-hmm. that provided all kinds of solidarity networks. So the question is, in terms of strategizing, because we have to build a new movement. There is no other choice, right? Yeah. And the young people that I'm teaching, I have to say, in the 5 years I've been at UMass in that department teaching, when I would articulate a critical perspective on capitalism explicitly, mm-hmm. there was pushback to begin with. Mm-hmm. There were some people with mm-hmm. me, but there were a lot of people who were nervous with what I was saying. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying people are waving the red flag, but they're not far from that. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't know to wave the red flag, but they know that capitalism is not working for them. Mm-hmm. They know that. They mm-hmm. know. They see what their friends who've graduated don't get. You know, they know what their economic situation or lack thereof is. So mm-hmm. the question becomes, what do we have to give in terms of a strategy, a vision? I think that's one of the biggest problems, is that mm-hmm. most of these people have no sense that things can be any different. This is the way it is. That's mm-hmm. what anti-communism has done. Mm-hmm. That there's no alternative to this political economy. Mm-hmm. This is it, mm-hmm. right?
You know, I think one thing to say to that is that one of the upsides of I guess, you know, my generation, the millennials, you know, is that we grew up in a period that was sort of past the worst ravages of anti-communism. I think it was at that point, it was like steeped in our, you know, obviously in our parents' generation, but it wasn't something that was as persistently harped on since mm-hmm. the Soviet Union had fallen. And we were in this period that was sort of conceived of as, you know, capitalism won. And so there wasn't this need to constantly be like, you know, look at those Soviet devils. And I feel like, you know, there was a poll that was done, I think a Rasmussen poll just last year, what actually mm-hmm. said that people in my generation, are getting closer and closer to a point of saying, actually, capitalism doesn't work for me, and socialism sounds like something I might like to hear more about, which I think is a really exciting development. I mean, and it's, I think we're entering into a period where, you know, the youth globally, not just in the United States, but globally, are starting to reject the tired old politics of yesteryear, this politics that constantly channels all of our activity into electoral politics, that says, you know, we just need to get more Democrats into office and then, you know, things will be fixed in this country and this state. We, of course, in Massachusetts on the left, know pretty darn well that getting more Democrats into office doesn't really change anything, since we've had a Democratic majority in the state for the last 53 years. And yet we still have, you know, slow and steady austerity politics. I think we are in a period where we have an opening and an opportunity to really start to organize, you know, these solidarity networks, this, you know, a broader fight back. I think the important thing is for those people who are sort of the most committed activists is to recognize that we need to be fighting back against the right at every opportunity that it pops up. You know, whether it's fighting for, you know, this rally that you mentioned on, you know, next Thursday, this union busting, you know, attempt to block collective bargaining rights of Northampton teachers. I think, you know, we should be all out for that. We need to stand in solidarity with our teachers, because it's incredibly important. But it's through those acts of solidarity that we build these networks of solidarity. We can't just sort of sit in our armchairs and say, you know, how can we get more people to come to these things? We need to actually mm-hmm. be going to these mm-hmm. things when they're happening, making arguments with people when we're there, saying that, you know, this is one part of a much broader attack on working class rights. The only way that we're going to really do anything about it is if we all band together to fight it.
Any other thinking? I mean, I would wrestle with you there. I'm ready to start wrestling with that, because I mean, we do need to come to these things, but the reality is that you have a highly depoliticized group of young people, cohorts, that just saying we have to fight the right to people who already not there with you is not going to get them to come to a demonstration. Mm. It's just not going to work. It's just not going to work. And so that's the reality, right? You hear the culture that Willie was a part of that was just natural in their everydayness, right? So it's I mean, we had this 2 years ago. There was a rally, March 22nd, or I don't know what it was. It was a National Day of Action.
March 4th,
right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there was this tremendous mobilization around this one day of action. Mm-hmm. You did this action. I went to one or two of the meetings. We marched around the campus. We usually you rally, you get the same 150 people, and that was it. Mm-hmm. And in terms of building a longer term cultural resistance and solidarity, it didn't. I don't think we brought in. I mean, the young people that I teach, nobody heard about it. Nobody participated in it. I had suggested, and I wasn't involved in the long term planning, but just in terms of different strategies. The possibility of, for example, creating a kind of comedy guerrilla antics troupe, John Stewart style, that would interrupt lecture halls, 200, 300 person lecture halls. So instead of marching around the campus or in tandem with that, you get 10 troops of people to interrupt 10 classes of 300 people. You hit 3,000 students with some sense of humor of what the crisis is. And what their relationship is to it as they're wedded, you know, to their mobile device and all this death and destruction, mayhem is happening about them, but all they care about is their Twitter account, you know, twittering away while you know, the campus is burning or whatever it may be. People are being beaten all around them. And then from that, building some kind of solidarity of people who are doing theater together. I don't know. I don't have any answers, but I'm saying that I think that to bring in young people and others, the Alliance for Peace and Justice in Northampton, which is one of the most activist group, you go to their meetings and most of the people are 60 years and older. There are very few young people at these meetings, right? So, you know, we're on the right side or the left side, right? We're there already. But you've got a whole cohort of young people who are highly depoliticized. And the question is, how do we get to them? Or at least that's a question I have. And I think we need to think in new ways.
This is interesting because I've had this debate and with numerous people. Personally, separate from some of the student activism I do, I've been involved with Greens in Massachusetts, and it's funny. I'd always argue we had a co-chair who was very much into social networking, very much into you know, media theory as well, and I would have these debates with him regarding how to do organizing, you know, and he kind of, you know, had this view, and I think a lot of people might agree with it, of, you know, kind of the spectacle, you know, the coming from different, you know, people, kind of just saying that, you know, we, you know, our culture is not ours. It's corporate, it's capitalist culture. It's, you know, it's been colonized by, you know, other forces that are not, you know, indigenous or autonomous or, you know, self-generating. So he, you know, basically would say, well, we got to do the lowest common denominator, you know, yeah, even though he's read all this, he's basically still making the argument. Well, yeah, you know, I know that I can get a bunch of people to, you know, go to a bar with me and watch Red Sox. You know, that's the kind of politics we have to have. That's what the right's doing. If you look at the right, if you look at, listen to their talk shows, you know, it's very, you know, emotional, much more based on symbolism, much more, you know, it's gut level stuff, and they know that, and they know how to play that up. But I mean, I think one issue is that, you know, that there's a portion of the population that I think that needs to be done with. And, you know, even I think going back to your example of, you know, the Jewish radicals on the Lower East Side, I mean, clearly this was someone who was an intellectual. This was not, you know,
but he was a worker.
Yeah, he was, but that's the thing, though. But
he never went to any kind of schooling except Cheder. It was radical. You know, he went to a Jewish school, Cheder, and that was it. Mm-hmm. There was no other school in his life.
To finish my
he
thought,
he went to the Jefferson School Union, you know, in Union Square, the communist school for classes. But that otherwise, no.
But to finish my thought, though, there was, you know, he mentioned literary societies. He mentioned, you know, in the daily life of it, and part of it, you know, what I see, you know, in the past, a lot of radical parties, the socialists and the populists, it was very cultural. You know, in the Populist Party, people would meet at the Grange. You know, they were all farmers. They all related to it. And they, you know, there were speaking tours. And, you know, when they would have, you know, musical events or entertainment, it would be mixed in with a political side to it. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult, I find, to now, you know, these are 100-year-old examples, and, you know, you can debate them all you want. But in terms of, like, very practical organizing, you know, I can't, it's difficult to take a given cultural, you know, entertainment or artifact and turn it into something that's political and edgy and creates resistance out of people that aren't already kind of in tune with it. You know, with my organizing with SLAP, I mean, a lot of the campuses, you know, I also do...
What is SLAP, first tell us?
Student Labor Action Project. It's a joint project of Jobs with Justice and the United States Student Association. And one of the reasons it was created on the union side was to bring in, you know, youth, because labor knows that, you know, it's been on a bad trajectory for the last, you know, 50 years or more, and they have to bring in youth politics. And on the other side, it's... Well, there's this experienced organizing, this militancy that can be found in labor and on college campuses that students could get plugged into by being involved with SLAP. So the logic of it, it's a self-reinforcing logic, and that you're, you know, creating conditions where you're politicizing students, educating students, not only in, you know, just the politics and lingo of activism, but also the, you know, the face-to-face, you know, grassroots organizing. I'm losing my train of thought. But I think, but what I was going to say again was, in my organizing, you know, the people that can form groups that can be immediately become organizers usually already have some level of political awareness. For me, I was already someone who was into socialist and anarchist politics when I was in high school. That's not the majority of young people. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people, you know, go through a process of, you know, politicalization. But, you know, again, certain things that the progressive movement, the left movement does, you know, attract certain kinds of people, and they become more politicized, but then huge swaths of the population, it doesn't do a thing for them. It's not interesting. It's not compelling. You know, it's, and, you know, I think, you know, a lot of the stuff that went on in the 60s, you know, was a sign of trying to grapple with, you know, an increasingly corporatized culture and playing around with it and, you know, making fun of it and getting people involved like that. But, you know, that process, you know, stuff back then that was radical has now become completely safe and non-radical. You know, the peace sign is sold on everything. Che Guevara mm-hmm. shirts are everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't have the same radical or critical connotations that they might have had in the past. So you can't. So it's more difficult to appropriate those kinds of symbols and ideas. But so I guess that's a whole lot of criticism and not a whole lot of, well, this is what we should do.
Well, we have to figure it out. Joe, have you any thoughts on this? Just this idea of a culture of resistance or...
Well,
I mean, what do you see? We were talking about just the conditions that... I mean, you're now out of school about 3 years, 4 years, few years out
yeah,
of school?
Yeah, I guess something like that, yeah. About 3 years.
And
yeah.
So, you know, you have a cohort of young people. And as we've talked before about them, most of them are working these low pay jobs, working several jobs perhaps,
right.
to just...
Yeah, the AmeriCorps factor.
The AmeriCorps, yeah. and then, you know, I mean, you're working two jobs, right?
Yeah, I'm working a couple jobs, making it work. I feel very fortunate that, you know, I have jobs that I can work at, yeah, but... Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the thing with AmeriCorps and other, you know, Teach for America, these kinds of post undergraduate social work programs can be very appealing for someone who, you know, like Patrick says, may have gotten that politicization at some point, felt like they didn't want to just go study accounting, go to a faceless accounting firm and, you know, work their lives away. They wanted to make a change, do something good. And so what is there to do? Well, hey, you can be a paper pusher at this social work agency, get paid less than minimum wage, but at least you don't have to pay your loans back for another 9 months or so. Yeah, I mean, it's not, I don't know. It doesn't seem like that's the radical vision of transforming alienated youth into agents of social change after they've got a college degree. It's more of that indentured servitude you're talking about.
Yeah, I feel like there's that's a symptom that we see in our society today. That's, you know, very individualized. You know, that basically says, you know, you see something wrong out there in the world, you go and you get a job and you make that difference. Mm-hmm. You alone. And that you know, I kind of feel like, you know, it's like the Oprah effect. You know, it's a it's, you know, proposing individual solutions to what are really societal or systemic problems. Yeah. Unfortunately, that whole sort of philosophy is utterly bankrupt. You know, the only way to change systemic problems is through organization, is through mass popular pressure. That ultimately, when we pursue politics at an atomized or an individualized level, it you know, the balance of power is against our favor. And ultimately, we end up, you know, getting convinced that, you know, our true political power, you know, comes at the ballot box, which unfortunately just maintains, you know, the monologue of the state, where it doesn't matter which party is in power. We're still getting right now the message of, well, we need to cut the public sector and maintain the tax cuts, which anyone with even, you know, half a grain of economic sense would say, well, that's a whole bunch of hogwash. I do think absolutely we need to be working at building and organizing. And I do think that there's a lot of work that's going on right now to build and organize. The problem, of course, is, you know, you say, oh, well, where is it? Where is the sort of the visible, you know, why don't we have Tahrir Square happening right now in downtown Northampton? And I think, you know, obviously, you know, the struggle is, you know, it has its ups and downs, and it's it can have an appearance of episodic nature until it doesn't. But to get to that point where we can have a Tahrir Square takes a lot of work.
We have just a few minutes left here. This is the Bread and Roses Show on WXOJ 103.3, and we're here with Ben Taylor and Patrick Burke and Joe Merkin, three organizers here who are kicking butt in their own ways. It's great to have you in this room. The terrific trio here. I'm gonna try to see how we can kind of carry this on somehow.
Yeah, it's a space like this where to get the organizing work done, to organize the people, you got to have these kinds of meetings of the minds. You've got to have one-on-one meetings with other folks. You've got to share ideas. You've got to see what these different organizations are doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got to plug yourself back in if you were involved in some point, you know, and then dropped out for whatever reason. You've got to re-engage yourself. Never stop learning, never stop talking.
So anyone on air, if you're not doing anything, well, go to one of these events.
You know. You can also get involved in Valley Free Radio. We're always looking for programmers. We have spaces for people to create their own shows on issues of news and politics, culture, education. Lots of music shows. So if you're interested at all, go to our website. That's valleyfreeradio.org. And there's a place there for you to put in a program proposal. We have trainings the first Sunday of every month from noon to 3, except if there's a holiday, which in July, it's that weekend is the July 4th weekend. But we welcome you, and we are one of the networks that exists at this point where there is other points of view besides a corporate point of view that's heard, mm-hmm. which is what generally seems to kind of cloud. It's the cloud that hangs over the poison, that the air that we breathe but don't even see, that corporate ideology. Okay, we've just got a minute here. I guess that's going to be it for today's show. Any last quick in 2 seconds or more? Anything last minute to say?
Do a chant.
A chant. What's the chant? Yeah, give us. Let's go out with a little chant. 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? No, that's not the chant.
Student power, worker power.
Student power, worker power.
Student power, worker power.
Student power, worker. Power.
Right. Yeah, we'll work on that. Yeah.
One union of all workers. I'm the Wobbly kind of vision of, you know, that we all have to kind of see ourselves as one general union, that the vast overwhelming majority of people in this country are working people, and to begin to see ourselves as being a union together.
Absolutely.
And that the class struggle is a generalized struggle, articulated through healthcare, through public transportation, through housing, through finance, et cetera. So that's the politics to build.